too. We were talking about your time before the war, and I wondered whether, as a young lad, you weren't very old, whether you were aware of what was going on in Germany, the rise of Hitler, foreign affairs, and the prospect of war. Was any of this of any relevance to you as a young lad at that time?
I was aware of Hitler. I was aware that he was a menace, but that was probably only towards the beginning of the war, when all the political things were going on. I remember Chamberlain, for instance, and his attempts at peace. I remember Sir Oswald Mosley doing his parading. The fascists, wasn't it? And I would remember things like the R101 that crashed the airship.
Did you see sort of Hitler as a menace to you? I mean, that you would be. Could you see it coming that you'd be in the army and the rest of it, or was it something that was just going on in Europe?
Well, I didn't see him as a menace to England, particularly at that time, being only young, because I think we'd been brought up on the British Empire, and as kids, I think we thought Britain was just about invincible and nothing could touch us. You know, that was almost, well, in fact, up to, say, going into Normandy, when we went in thinking our tanks were invincible until we saw what happened to some of them. And that was our background. We grew up with this idea that the British Empire was the all-conquering outfit.
What preparations were made for, I mean, moving now right into 39, before you were evacuated at the start of September, what sort of preparations were made where you were living? I mean, the farmhouse and Sippenham. Did any of the, were they digging air raid shelters and things like that, or was it a bit of a surprise to you?
I think very little was done. Certainly, we never had an air raid shelter at the farmhouse. We probably relied on the cellars, but then they were, I think, in emergency we might have used them, but I don't ever remember us using the cellars. When any bombing was going on that was sounding close, this is the early part of the war, when I happened to be home for the weekend, we go by the guidelines they'd issued that the chimney breast was about the safest place to be, and so you'd all scatter or get under the table or go in the corners by the chimney breast and rely on, if the house collapsed, that those corners or under the table might, you know, get you out of trouble. So we didn't actually do much. When it actually began, I think we went through the motions of putting tape on the windows.
I will come back. So before the war, so the first thing that really affected you then was the evacuation just before the outbreak of war itself.
Yes.
What happened then? How was it organised, and what, as far as you were concerned, as?
You mean the firm? Yes. Well, the firm, they had a place to go to. Why they chose Harpenden was because one of the managing directors had a big house there up on the hill, and he had sufficient land around the house to get some huts built. Well, these huts weren't finished. You know, this had all happened quickly. And so the huts were being built to house the activities of the insurance company. And what they did, they hired a country mansion called the Red House. I've still got a picture of that somewhere. And all our files, we were in charge of the filing, you see, so we had to help with the files being moved by lorry out of London. And they were all deposited on these stable floors in the old stables of this mansion. But that didn't last long. I would imagine at the most probably about a month or so, and then we were moved into these brand new huts. They're about the size of barrack rooms, I suppose they were, these huts, single story. And it was from these huts that we heard the news of the fall of France eventually.
So you lived up there in Harpenden?
Yes, the office organised billets for us, you know, lodgings. Billets is an army expression, isn't it? Lodgings, they would call it. And because we were on very low pay, you know, such sort of pay as about, well, in the early stages, perhaps about £75 a year, because of that, they give us a means test form, and we'd have to fill this form up in great detail as to how our income was allocated and what expenses we had, and then they would top it up with sufficient to pay for the lodgings. But I suspect that some pressure was put on the local people to house us. And I don't think a lot of the people were very happy about the idea of putting us up. And we found that there was not much of a friendly atmosphere. And it was almost as if we were foreigners. And consequently, you'll find in there that I changed my lodgings at fairly frequent intervals, along with my colleague at the time. Because of that, and I did finally end up in a good lodging with somebody that was a little bit more reasonable, and they were that was a family with quite a large house and some, you know, good background. So the firm helped us, in other words, with the lodgings, the expenses. But because of the atmosphere in the lodgings, I used to get my bicycle out every weekend and cycle home, which was 32 miles. I cycle home on the, well, in summertime, I would set off on the Friday after work in the evening. But in the winter, it would probably be a Saturday when I did it, you know, rather than pedal it through the darkness. But I got pretty good, being a keen cyclist, I got pretty good at covering that journey. I think I recorded an average speed of 19.5 miles per hour, I think, for that journey once.
Were there any other effects on the firm of moving? I mean, were there changes in staff with people going off to war, or was it basically the main impact just the move?
Yes, there were changes. People of older age groups did disappear. Quite a few went into the Air Force, and we saw them coming back on their leaves, all resplendent in their uniforms. And the other effect, I should mention that the Century, like the French Provident, was of Quaker origins, you see, because my manager of my department, for instance, was a chap called Herbert Rantry, who was from that family, the chocolate firm, who were Quakers, if you know. And so, with that Quaker background, some of the employees were Quakers. And so it probably wouldn't surprise you that a number of the staff, when it came to call-up time, they disappeared into either the Friends Ambulance Unit or the Men Army and such like.
They were conscientious objectors?
Yes. So there were a few from the firm like that. In fact, I bought my motorcycle eventually from one who was going into the Land Army because my older brother had persuaded me that cycling all that way at the weekend was a bit tough, and wouldn't I rather learn how to ride a motorbike? And so eventually that proved useful in the Home Guard as a dispatch rider.
Now, so you'd learnt to ride the motorbike before you joined? Now, the Home Guard was formed in 1940, the LDV, Local Defence Volunteers. At what stage did you become involved? Was it right at the start?
It was right at the start, only a few days after Anthony Eden's announcement. I joined it.
You heard the speech, and where did you go to join? I mean, where were you had to report?
It must have been at some council building, I would imagine, down in Harpenden. I can't can't quite remember where at this stage, but we did have some central place to go to report. And then from there they scattered you around the district if you were, say, involved in guarding some particular spot. But with my duties being dispatch rider...
You were picked for that straight away, were you?
I think they probably asked me what I wanted to do, and I probably said, well, I've got a motorbike, can I be of use? And I think I probably put in there that I had my eye on the petrol allowance, you say. There might be a spin-off there, because petrol was rationed, and I could only make the journey home on the motorbike at sort of intervals. And I'd have to get the pedal cycle out and interchange because of the petrol situation. So the home guard, I'd probably have an eye on the petrol, hoping that there might be a little spin-off there.
Now, what sort of... Did they issue you with a uniform? I mean, we know there were problems with the uniform. Did you get a uniform and equipment early on, or...?
Not straight away. We got the armband, the LDV armband. And then eventually did get a battle dress outfit. I can't remember having a gun. I can't remember having a rifle. Because... Obviously, I would have remembered that because I would have to have found methods of carrying it on the motorbike. So
the motorbike was your own?
Yes, it was.
And what about basic training with them? I mean, did you have a night when you'd report and be trained, drill, the rest of it, or was it mainly practical based?
Well, let's think back now. I think it was formed in May 1940, wasn't it, after the collapse of France. And I went in the army the following year, July 41. So that gave me just over a year. And I think they were so much in their early stages then that I never remember it getting quite like Dad's army. I don't remember drilling with them, for instance. I don't even remember assembling them in great numbers with them. I think we acted more as individuals and reported. My signal to report was when the air raid sirens blew off, you see. Otherwise, they weren't in telephone communication with us or anything. Although I think my landlady had the telephone. A lot of people didn't in those days, of course. Very good on the phone. But nevertheless, I don't think they used the phone. To individuals, so we had to rely on the air raid siren, and that was the signal to report for duty. And of course, that would be triggered off largely by enemy aircraft. But then the Home Guard, I suppose, existed to spot parachutists dropping and things like that.
So, when you were called out, what would you do exactly? What was a common point you'd go to?
I would simply go down to the central reporting point and await orders.
And what might happen then?
I might be given a message to deliver somewhere, to some outpost. I probably did one or two little jobs like that, but I don't remember. You see, Harpenden was a country place. It didn't often get the sirens. But there were a few bombs dropped in the area. In fact, one landed, I think, quite near the offices. But there wasn't an awful lot of trouble there. There were dogfights and things like that occasionally. But not a tremendous amount of bombing. So probably we didn't get involved too much.
And you didn't train as a unit, as far as you were concerned?
No, I don't ever remember doing the sort of things you see on the television programmes. That must have come later, much later in the war, when they gradually found means of equipping them properly. But we were certainly in very, very basic stages then.
So... anything else about this period before you were recruited, or called up in July 41?
Yes, I did probably put in there, almost certainly, one journey home on the motorbike when I was going up a hill near Hemel Hempstead when I heard the sound of firing and I could see something hitting the field nearby, and I got the feeling that this aircraft was shooting at me because there was nothing else about. And so I hastily flung myself off the motorbike into the hedge and looked up and saw a dogfight in progress then, and so these bullets might have been strays from the dogfight, or the start of it might have been the enemy aircraft spotting me. I suppose they were after anything that was moving in those days, but certainly that shook me up a bit. And that was the weekend that I was off home to my older brother's wedding, so that must have been 1940. I've probably got the date in there somewhere, but yes, I think he got married in May 1940, so that must have been all about the time of this collapse of France, business, you know. The Germans were beginning to feel cock-a-hoop, I suppose, and they were coming over England and not finding much opposition at that time.
Now, there's a fair bit in your memoirs, which I've got in front of me, which you've referred to occasionally. A fair number of accidents seem to litter this period of various sorts. I mean, any of them serious, or...?
No, nothing terribly serious. Although the incident when I had a puncture in St Albans, I expect you filmed that. Yes, that was nothing serious. I did get hit by a lorry that must have swerved... you know, he must have let go of the steering wheel or something, because there was nothing else about at the time, and I couldn't understand afterwards how on earth he could have hit me with such a wide road to play with. But anyway, it did injure my back at the time, but being young and supple, I suppose I got over it eventually.
Any other accidents?
Yes, there was another accident when I bought the chap that went into the Land Army. I bought his Excelsior motorcycle and had an accident with that later on in the blackout when I'd been visiting an old school friend and coming back to Sippenham in the dark with all these smoke screens going. They had these things like greenhouse heaters belching out all of this smoke to cover the industrial estate at Slough. Trading estate, and I was going through all this murky, thick smoke, looked like a fog. And when I got to Sippenham, there was a cinema there which happened to be turning out at the time, and I crashed into the side of the car, which had his nose out in the road with no lights, of course. They got blackout masks, but being sideways on, I didn't see him. I was going along hugging the curve as a guide and just went into him. Fortunately, it not at any great speed. But it did damage the front forks of the Excelsior. Never quite got back to normal with it, because the repairer said it would be very expensive to straighten the head that the forks were mounted in. He straightened the forks for me, but not the head. So it always had a slight tendency to want to veer off. So one arm got tired and the other trying to stiff it.
Well, was the blackout a big problem as a donor and as a personal cyclist and motorcyclist?
I think if you knew the area, you could get by. You had to use the roadside as a marker, and it certainly was a problem. You had to cut your speed down, of course. You very rarely managed to get into top gear. If it was a moonless night, and you were dependent on that tiny little slip of light from your headlight, you really had to focus that on the edge of the road and perhaps get up into third gear, something like that, but very rarely in top, unless it was a moonlight night.
Now, you also, I think, you were studying for your Chartered Insurance Institute examinations, or so. That would be important to you. Was that your career that you were going into, and that would, yes, presume a professional qualification?
Yes, the most companies in those days insisted that you went in for these exams, and you could take them in. In the early days, you had to take whole parts at once. That's three subjects, and you had to pass in all three subjects. It was no good if you passed in two and not in the other. You still had to take it all again then the next year. But eventually they got down, when the war broke out, they got down to making concessions and you could take individual subjects, which made it a bit easier. But I went through the painful process of taking part one for one go and got that. I was lucky that I got that. And I think that was as far as I got by the time I got in the army. That was the end of the study then, a while, until the war finished. And when I got back to it, I got postal courses sent to me in Germany.
Now, what about conscription? I mean, you must have been aware it was coming up. How did you feel about joining the army and or whatever you were conscripted to do? Did you have an opinion about it as you approached?
Yes. As I said earlier, we had this background of the British Empire in our minds, and then two colleagues and I talked it over and decided that we were going to get caught up. We were quite excited, having seen the others coming back on leave, we were quite excited about going into uniform and doing something. From my point of view, I didn't have any ideas of making it a career. Don't forget, I wasn't married at the time, I was very young, 19. And I didn't, in retrospect, looking with hindsight, I didn't feel very mature at the time. I felt still very much of a lad, but excited at the idea of uniform, going into a new sphere of life, getting away from the office for a while, and that tedious clerical work. Any thoughts? Although, as you can see from my attestation form over there, I was a volunteer, and so were the other two colleagues. I was a volunteer, but as I said, I don't think I wanted to make it a career particularly. I just wanted to do it myself. I wanted to be on the winning side, and I felt that we were on the winning side, that in spite of everything, we'd show them. But that was it. People have asked me, why didn't I sort of go up the scale, sort of become a Lance Corporal, Corporal Sergeant? Frankly, I didn't want to.
I will come back to that, because that's the yeah. Now, so you decided to volunteer. You did not wait. I mean, you were due to be conscripted, but you didn't.
That's right.
You made a point of volunteering. You also seem to have gone with your work colleagues, Wallace and Sisley.
Yes, I did.
Was that a decision you made together, or was it a coincidence?
We made it together, yes. We talked it over, and we were much of the same age group, and we thought, this is going to happen to us, and we all agreed that our thoughts in those days were that regiments like the infantry were definitely foot soldiers. We had no idea that in later part of the war they would be transported around like we saw in the tanks. We saw occasionally infantry regiments being transported to their particular area. Now, we didn't want to be foot soldiers. And we thought there was something much more interesting than being part of an infantry regiment. Although now, I feel that those poor infantry men, they play a vital part in the war, and I don't want to denigrate them in any way. It's just that we as young lads didn't want to go into what we thought was just foot slogging, marching miles and miles with heavy packs on their backs.
Did the First World War influence you at all? I mean, because the infantry had borne the brunt of that. I mean, did that have an influence on your not wanting to go into the infantry?
I think you're right. That could possibly in the background. I don't think we talked about it in that light, but I think that could have been lurking in the background.
But that wasn't expressed.
It wasn't expressed. No.
Now, what did you decide to go for? Because you didn't go for the armoured corps straight away, the tanks straight away, did you?
No. They all had their own ideas. I was, as you found out, interested in mechanics. And I realised that being short-sighted, that I wouldn't have any earthly chance of becoming a pilot.
With the RAF.
That's right. Exciting, the idea of being a pilot, naturally, but I knew I would never have the chance. But the idea of being sort of maintaining aircraft appealed to me enormously. Mechanical side, you know, keeping them in tip-top order, hearing all the tales of what they've been up to and so on, you know. And the other two, well, they probably wanted, well, one wanted to be a gunner, he was interested in gunnery, and the other chap was interested in virus operation. And that's what they became. But when we all turned up at Edgware...
This is the recruiting office?
Recruiting office at Edgware.
Edgware Road? Or
Edgware, I think it was called Edgware, yes. It probably was in Edgware Road.
But it was the Edgware area of London?
Yes.
And what happened when you got there?
When we got there, we were ushered into a room. The chap in uniform sat at the table, and he said, well, what would you like to join then? And we said, Air Force. And he asked us all individually what experience we had. And, of course, as we were all clerks, he said, well, you have no experience at all in any of these things. He said, I'm afraid we can't enrol you in the Air Force, any of you. And so we thought we'd be clever then. We thought, but there is such a thing as the fleet air arm. How about that, being on a ship and actually associated with aircraft? Oh, no, he said, you can't. No, that's the same answer. He said, if you haven't any experience, you won't be of any use to them. And obviously he was probably thinking of training and the time it would take to train. But he said, without any experience, he said, you could go into the tanks. And we thought, I hadn't even thought about the tanks. That sounds very exciting. Being part of a tank regiment, and then, of course, memories came back to us of pictures showing tanks in action of the old type. And probably we thought of the vital part they played in the First World War. So, yes, we were quite keen. He said, yes, put us down for the tanks. We still didn't know where we were going to be sent. But I was over the moon, believe it or not, at the idea. When I got the calling up papers to go to Catterick, I said, Rupee, I'm going to Yorkshire.
And were you being called up as a trainee fitter or anything, or were you just going in as a normal trooper?
Just going in as a normal trooper. Going through the squad, all the basic training.
So at the time there was no specialisation, you were just going to be a squaddie in the tank.
6 weeks of basic training.
Now, anything else happened? Did you get the King's Shilling and things as a volunteer? Or?
Yes, we did get that. Yes, we got the King's Shilling. I can't remember whether it was a shilling or a half crown in those days. But
and what about a medical? Was that done then, or any sort of examination of whether you were fit?
That's strange. I can't remember. There probably was some very sort of preliminary medical down at the same time. But certainly we went through the medical side when we got to Catterick.